Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We live in a world largely made by science. Discoveries in medicine have lengthened lifespans and eradicated diseases that were once lethal. Technological breakthroughs have arguably changed how we live and how well we live. And yet today, science is under attack. Just a cursory look at what's happening at the CDC is clear evidence of that. This is certainly alarming to medical professionals and scientists of all disciplines, and it should be alarming to all of us. But the question is why? Why are the very things that have saved and prolonged lives, the very things that have made lives better, being challenged, dismissed, discarded? Doctors Michael E. Mann and Peter J. Hotez believe they know why. Mann is a professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Hotez is dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine and professor of pediatrics and molecular virology and microbiology at Baylor College of Medicine. And they say these attacks are putting us on an unsustainable path and are both politically and ideologically motivated by powerful special interests. Together, they've written a book about it, Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World. And Dr. Michael Mann joins us for the hour to tell us more. Thank you for being here. Good morning.
Thank you, Mike. It's great to be with you.
Before we get to the particulars that you write about in this book, you and your co-author, we should mention that this book has cost you personally. You were at the University of Pennsylvania's Vice Provost for Climate Science Policy and Action, and you resigned from that position because Penn has a neutrality policy which prohibits its leaders from making public statements in response to external events. Now, this book is not neutral, nor is its promotion neutral. And when it comes to scientists warning the public of potentially negative consequences of public policy, it would seem to be the role of universities and the experts that they employ to be the warning sounders. If you as an expert cannot share your thoughts about policies that are in conflict with your area of expertise, what's the purpose of a university?
Well, thanks, Mike. This is a university that was founded by Benjamin Franklin, right? And on principles, obviously a founding father who very passionately believed in freedom of speech. He was obviously opposed to authoritarianism. I sometimes wonder, I ask myself, what would Ben think? What would Ben say today if he were here? I don't envy the university right now, and given the sort of political environment that universities find themselves in, there is this tendency to sort of shy away from anything that might be confrontational with respect to the current administration, given the aggression the administration has shown against academic institutions, including our institution specifically. So, I understand why the university has adopted this policy. And I just felt that I could not in good faith continue to serve as a university administrator at a time when it comes to climate science, when it comes to the public health. We can't be neutral with respect to the facts. The facts are what they are, and we have to speak truth to power, and we have to make sure people understand what the science actually says.
So is this neutrality policy at Penn something that is relatively new? Did it come online at around the time of the second Trump administration? Is this another example of a major institution bending the knee?
Yeah, so, I was pleased to see Penn actually reject this compact that Donald Trump has asked various universities to sign. And so they've shown some resolve here, and it was good to see that. They adopted this policy actually before the re-election of Trump. It was a year earlier in response to some of the controversy over you know, the Middle East, Gaza, student protests, and that actually ended up costing the president her job. Liz McGill, after a grilling by Congress, ended up stepping down as president. It was over that matter. It was over. It was purported to be free speech, although some of these people are for free speech when it's on their side and not when it's on the other side. But Penn was sort of caught in the crosshairs of that and adopted this policy.
You've experienced this kind of, personal attacks for quite a while because you, by profession, are a climate scientist, and we all know that there are these climate change deniers with deep, deep, deep pockets and moneyed interests that have been going after you and what you say is going on with the global climate. For years, it might have been a relatively new phenomenon for your co-author, Dr. Hotez, because he is, as I said, a virologist, a microbiologist, and somebody who deals in a cursory way with public health. Well, pardon me, I'm say it again.
A pediatrician as well.
Pediatrician. And you, your co-author, Dr. Anthony Fauci, have all been attacked and threatened with attack, and your families have been threatened with attack because of your professional scientific views, which are based in science. These two disciplines, climate science and microbiology, are very different disciplines, I suppose. But there are powerful interests who have a big stake in what happens in both those areas. Are there other scientific disciplines that we haven't really heard about that are facing the same things that you and your co-author have faced?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And our perspective is primarily as two scientists who work in these two different fields, climate science and public health, that have been, where the science has been under assault by those vested interests, ideologically motivated actors, as you allude to. But this is true across the board. What we're seeing is any science that might be disadvantageous, the implications of which might be disadvantageous to powerful special interests, has been attacked. Even research into disinformation, right, has been attacked by those who are promoting disinformation, right? Because it's Stanford University, for example, ended up dissolving their laboratory for the study of disinformation. Tobacco, guns, you name it. Anytime scientific research has found itself on a collision course with, again, these powerful moneyed vested interests, the result has been the same. There has been a concerted effort to undermine public faith in the science.
I hadn't thought about guns, but tobacco certainly comes to mind because tobacco, we all know from the 60 Minutes report from years ago, spent a lot of money to suppress information about its link to cancer. And somehow that information came out despite the fact that they had spent tons of money for years to suppress it. Do you understand why? Because these people... The tobacco manufacturers had sons and daughters and grandchildren who were going to die from cancer because of smoking, and yet they tried to suppress that information. Why?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's something we all ask, right? They're mothers and fathers. They have children. They have grandchildren. How can they do this? And I think, you know, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist. But, you know, I think there's a tendency to sort of separate sort of the actions that one takes as an executive at a corporation and the actions one might take in one's personal life. I think psychologically, maybe they tend to wall that off. And you hear really, you know, with the children's climate movement, for example, Greta Thunberg and child climate protesters that sort of came to... came to prominence a little less than a decade ago. You heard stories, for example, about fossil fuel executives, fossil fuel CEOs whose children were coming to them and saying, "Daddy, why are you destroying the world?" You can just imagine the psychological impact that must have. I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but I do think that has been the tendency to sort of wall off those policies and not internalize them as a human being, as a parent or a grandparent.
You and your co-author deal in different areas of science that both deal with what you describe as existential threats, because Dr. Hotez deals with pandemics and the viruses and other things that result that could result in pandemics that could have a severe impact on human life on Earth. And certainly climate science is rearing its ugly head, the ugly side of climate science, which is telling us that we're this close to a tipping point that may cause severe, have severe implications. Is the pushback against the work that you do and the information that you're bringing to the fore, is it worse today? Because it's been going on for years, but is it worse today for some reason?
Yeah, thanks. It's a great question. And, you know, and these two things interact, right? Because climate change and environmental destruction is actually exacerbating these pandemics. So they're synergistic in a bad way. And, you know, we sort of frame it as there are three existential crises. It's sort of a three-legged stool, if you like. There's the climate crisis. There's the threat of ever more deadly pandemics. And the biggest crisis of all is the rise of anti-science misinformation and disinformation, because it renders us unable to meaningfully respond to any of the challenges, any of the crises that we face. So, you know, there is, that's sort of where we are right now. If we can't do something about the propagation of misinformation and disinformation, then we're in big trouble.
In the preface to your book, you say, quote, there is a highly organized, well-funded campaign of anti-science, and you say that it has now emerged as its own deadly force. And you call this, and I don't think you mean this as hyperbole, you call this a literal struggle between good and evil. I don't think I've ever heard anybody put it in those terms, but you say it's also an anti-science superstorm. It's a struggle between good and evil. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, As a writer, I'm often influenced by fictional narratives, even as I'm writing about actual real-world events. It's nonfiction, but sometimes there are narratives, powerful narratives from fiction that really resonate with us. And to me, as I was writing this book, The Lord of the Rings was resonating with me. And we sort of draw out that analogy, you know, the different players and extend that metaphor as far as one possibly can in the book. But it really does feel that way to me, right? On the one hand, there are these powerful actors who are looking to maximize their power, their influence, and their wealth at the expense of the rest of humanity and the planet. I don't think Tolkien could have dreamed up a real-world example that rivals the fictional tale that he tells, and other fictional tales between good and evil. So to me, it was an obvious framing, because and sometimes framing it in ethical terms, framing it that way, can reach people who are, you know, when it's science, when it's economics, when it's cost-benefit analysis, people's eyes glaze over. But if you can make them understand that this is about something much bigger, then maybe they'll be willing to listen.
You and your fellow scientists, many of them have experienced threats and attacks on their personal safety, and as have your family. And I could understand this if this was coming from the CEO of Exxon, but many of these threats come from ordinary people. I want to come back and talk about that in just a couple of seconds, and how this may differ, if at all, from what the Catholic Church did to Galileo hundreds of years ago. We'll do that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at HabitatCharlotteRegion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Dr. Michael E. Mann, who, along with his co-author Peter Hotez, have written Science Under Siege. There must be a subtitle. Yes, there is. How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World. And you've described it in Tolkien-esque proportions. You say this is not a battle for the fate of Middle-earth, it's the battle for the fate of Earth itself. You and other scientists have come under attack, personal and threats of attack, personal and professional. You say that Fox News has described you and your colleague as cartoon villains or public enemies. How different is this from what the Catholic Church did to Galileo hundreds and hundreds of years ago because of what he said about the Earth not being the center of the universe?
Yeah, well, thanks. Obviously, any time one is compared to Galileo, it's of course, we don't pretend to be modern day Galileos, but interestingly, Peter and I talk about this. We have both been the subject of cartoons by editorial cartoonists who did make that connection, because you know the commonality here is science being under attack by authoritarian bodies because the findings of science are inconvenient to those bodies, whether it be the Catholic Church back in the days of Galileo. It was challenged by the heliocentric model of the universe. It went against their teachings, or climate science, or vaccines today.
It seems to me it's completely understandable why big moneyed interests would want to silence you and threaten you if you don't shut up about things that threaten their business model. But you're getting threats from ordinary people. Scientists are getting threats. Politicians are getting threats from ordinary people. They don't really have a skin in the game. So why?
Yeah, it's a great question. And we try to be very clear in the book, if we're talking about good and evil, if we're talking about heroes and villains, the villains aren't the individuals that we encounter, in our daily lives, maybe on social media, although many of those are actually professional trolls. Some of those spreaders of misinformation, disinformation that purport to be just individuals actually are, inauthentic accounts that are part of some larger effort. But no doubt, there are people that we encounter, whether on social media or in our actual daily lives, who question the science of climate change or pandemics, and they do. They're not the villains. They are the victims of a misinformation campaign that is intentionally trying to, create uncertainty and doubt about the science. And so we have to recognize that they're not the villains. They're the victims, and we can try to help them understand what the science actually says. Try to help them out of that hole that they find themselves in.
There is another book by this same title, Science Under Siege, by Todd Wilkinson. It was published in 1998, and he writes about the politicians' war on nature and truth, and about how economic pressures undermine scientific integrity in U.S. government agencies, where scientists are pressured to alter or suppress findings that conflict with various agendas. I don't know how familiar you are with that book, but is this book, book, an extension of that, or does it break new ground?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, and that book was written, it's 2.5 decades, nearly 3 decades ago, right? And it's a sad commentary that we were warned. Carl Sagan warned us that we were on this course back in the 1990s. Other great thinkers, scientists and thinkers, warned us that we were on this path, and we haven't taken the actions necessary to go down the path that we need to go down, a path where public policy and our public discourse and our conversations are guided by the findings of science when it comes to the great challenges we face.
Your book does take this push against science in a broader direction, broader than merely blaming politicians. You've pretty much laid out, you've identified 5 principal forces at work against science: the plutocrats, the authoritarian petrostates and polluters, and politicians who advocate for them, the pros, the propagandists, and increasingly the press. the mainstream media. There are a lot of P's in there, but let's start with the media. Let's start with the mea culpas over here in this section. How are mainstream media outlets participating in and perpetrating this fight against science and scientific findings? What are we doing?
Yeah, thanks. I'm both an aficionado of Tolkien and an aficionado of alliteration, and that comes through here, I think, in the book. There are more than enough peas to fill a pod in the way that we frame things. So the press, we didn't make that choice lightly because there are so many good journalists out there who, in fact, are helping the public understand the challenges we face and helping get the science out there. But there are some obvious bad actors. And we talk a lot about Rupert Murdoch and the Murdoch media empire, Fox News, the Wall Street Journal editorial pages, the New York Post, in Australia, the UK, other news out. He's got this global news network that he has used to promote anti-science propaganda, whether it's climate or COVID-19. And so there's an obvious villain. In fact, Rupert Murdoch actually inspired a Bond villain back in the 1990s. There was a movie with a media mogul as the villain who was, I'm trying to remember the Bond film. Was it The Living Daylight? I forget which one it was. He literally inspired a Bond villain, right? So that's what we're talking about. And Elon Musk, who bought Twitter and weaponized Twitter, it was funded in part, it was financed by Saudi Arabia and Russia to petrostates. So the plutocrats and the petrostates sort of working together to promote misinformation and disinformation that is in their interest. But I'll make one last point, Mike. It's easy, right, to vilify them and to point the finger at them, but we spend at least as much time and space calling out many mainstream media outlets, the New York Times and the Washington Post in particular, for engaging in what we call performative neutrality, where they elevate anti-science, the lab leak theory of COVID. On the editorial pages of the New York Post or the Washington Post, you would think that this is an equally viable theory of COVID-19 to what the actual scientific community is saying, that this was a zoonotic spillover. It was passed from, animals like pangolins and bats onto human beings. So they're not helping us. They're actually sowing doubt and distrust in the science and the scientists.
The mainstream media struggles with this, obviously with science, according to you, but also with politics, because the mainstream media, the legacy media, generally tries to give both sides of an argument so that people can make up their own minds and so that they, as journalistic entities, don't appear to be biased. And yet you are saying essentially that there are some things for which there is only one side, and to even consider the other side is a disservice. Is that accurate?
It is, and I would say that, There's the concept of working the refs. If you're a football or basketball fan, the coaches that are constantly yelling at the refs, "Hey, ref, the calls are all going against us." The intent is to actually move the refs in the direction of favoring you in the calls that they make. And that's what a lot of these bad actors have been doing with the media for so many years, that they've internalized this claim that the media was left-wing biased, there was a liberal bias to the media, when in fact the corporate media, if anything, have a conservative agenda that has pushed them in that direction. And we're seeing so many media outlets now literally bought by conservative plutocrats so that they can use it as a propaganda outlet.
But it puts ordinary mortals like journalists who are not scientists in a very sticky position, because absolutely, we don't know what you know. We don't have the tools at our disposal to verify what you say is accurate. And some scientists have been proven wrong, and other scientists out and out lie because they too have moneyed interests backing them, etc. So how are we, who are trying to only report the truth and not give credence to mis and disinformation, how are we to determine what is and what is not real?
Yeah, thanks. It's such a great question. And again, so many journalists do struggle with this, right? And a lot of the decisions that we're talking about are actually made by managers and editors, not by the journalists themselves. And so sometimes they're caught in the middle. I've seen that many times. You know, there are, and again, there is these same actors that we're talking about, these same five forces. Look, expertise is a threat to them. Trusted sources, a world where there are experts and they're trusted sources, is a threat to them because the facts aren't on their side. And so what they've tried to do is to undermine faith in, you know, authoritative scientific figures and bodies, to undermine public faith in science and scientists itself. And there are places you can go for objective takes on what the science of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. Look, if you're a Republican, it was founded by a Republican. It was founded by Abraham Lincoln back in the late 1800s as a body that could litigate matters, issues, science-based policy issues that have implications for policy. And so there's the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. There's the journals Nature and Science. There's Scientific American. There are all of these authoritative institutions, outlets that are out there that do provide, an objective assessment of the scientific consensus. And we can't do better than scientific consensus.
And yet there are those who would take issue with all of those things because they are state institutions not to be trusted.
That's right. And it's part of that, that tactic that I talked about. If you can undermine, public faith in institutions, you can get away with almost anything.
You warn us against the influence of plutocrats. These are people who are powerful simply because they are rich. The Koch brothers come to mind, as does Elon Musk, who today may become the most highly paid person in the world. He's about to be paid $1 trillion by Tesla if all things go in his direction. Both of these individuals, these plutocrats, are on the right. Are there any on the left who are putting the screws to science in similar ways?
It's a great question. You know, some would have called, some probably do call, Bill Gates, his critics on the right certainly accuse him of being a plutocrat who is in the tank for big pharma because he supports, vaccine research. He's done a lot of really good work in the public health space. And this was sort of a little bit of a conflict or a matter of contention between Peter and me as we wrote the book. In the public health arena, Gates has been actually very helpful in terms of his philanthropy, but he's been problematic, and there's a recent example of that we could talk about when it comes to climate.
Both he and Elon Musk have kind of reversed positions on certain things. I want to talk about Elon in a second, but let's talk about Bill Gates, because Bill Gates has done all the things that you said he's done. He's put a lot of his money to work for very good causes over the years, and so he was the knight in shining armor with the glowing halo. And yet, recently, he writes this memo in which he says that climate change will not end civilization. It is not, he says, an existential threat to humanity. Limiting temperatures, he says, temperature rise is not the best measure of progress. I don't know who made him a climate scientist, but talk about how he made that transition and how accurate or inaccurate and how dangerous or not dangerous it is.
Yeah, thanks. And, I actually was calling out Bill Gates a decade ago, back when he was making statements like, we need a miracle, like we're going to need new tech to decarbonize. We can't do it with the technology that we have. And that's simply not true. We've got that miracle. It's the sun, it's the wind, it's geothermal, it's energy storage technology. And there are, actual, experts who have assessed sort of the clean energy transition and what it will take, come to the conclusion that we can get most of the way to where we need to be. And sure, there are a few difficult to decarbonize sectors like cement production or air travel, and we're going to have to work on those. But that's like in the single digits in terms of the share of carbon emissions. And what Bill Gates likes to do is to point to those, that small number of difficult to decarbonize sectors and say, look, we can't do it. When in fact, for 90% of it, we can do it right now. and we can continue to develop technology to decarbonize those difficult to decarbonize sectors. But he uses that to reframe the entire thing. So we can't solve it with existing technology. We're going to need geoengineering. We shoot sulfur dioxide particles into the atmosphere to block out the sun. What could possibly go wrong? Bill Gates is literally funding research and potential deployment of that sort of technology, and he's doing it because he is calling into doubt the viability of clean energy, and it just goes against everything that actual experts are telling us.
And then there is Elon Musk, who also wore a halo for a long time, particularly among people on the left, because of his efforts to develop a viable electric car, which he arguably did. And he did so because he said he didn't want to be in the car business. He just wanted to show that it could be done so that other manufacturers would do it, and so we could stop our reliance on oil and have a cleaner planet. But now he has aligned himself with the Trump administration. He's thrown his lot in. He's cut scientific research efforts because of what he did in his position as the head of Doge, and he did it with a scythe rather than a scalpel. He also aligned himself with a pro-oil, pro-coal administration. How do you explain this? Because his trillion-dollar salary that he's liable to get today is based on electric cars.
Yeah. Well, you know, I said before, we talked about Rupert Murdoch having actually inspired a Bond villain, but there is no better example of the Bond villain arc than Elon Musk, who started out as an environmental hero, supporting clean energy technology, Tesla, Solar City, making solar panels cheaper, expanding the reach of clean energy to the people. He was rewarded. He received awards, and all sorts of accolades for the work that he was doing, helping the clean energy transition. And something happened, and with a lot of these folks, something happened during the pandemic, and we could spend a whole show talking about why that is, and it would be useful to have Peter here in the conversation if we were to do that. But something happened, and people's ideologies sort of were molded or altered by the experiences that they had during the pandemic, and Elon Musk was one of those. And so he underwent this Bond villain arc from hero to villain over the course of, you know, maybe 6, 7, 8 years. And he's doing all the things that you say right now. Everything he's doing goes against the very principles that he said first motivated him to pursue, you know, Tesla, Solar City, clean energy.
You're a climate scientist, and we're facing a moment in time that may be irreversible, according to many climate scientists. I want to talk about that and whether it's becoming more urgent because of what's happened politically in the last 9 or 10 months. We'll do that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting author Robin Wall Kimmerer, known for braiding sweetgrass and the service berry, sharing perspectives on Indigenous knowledge and ecology on December 2nd at the Gambrill Center. More at gambrillcenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is one of the co-authors of Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World. That guest is Dr. Michael Mann. He, along with Dr. Peter Hotez, wrote this book. Dr. Mann is a climate scientist and environmental scientist, and you are particularly concerned, and rightfully so, about climate change deniers who encourage the ongoing use of things that pollute the air and cause our climate to move steadily toward a tipping point, which we apparently are close to, because I think it's 1.5 centigrade more in temperature, and we've reached a critical temperature that is intolerable for human beings. How would you assess the efforts of people to delay anything, or to suppress anything that would prevent us from getting there in the last 9 months?
Yeah, thanks. Well, you know, it gets back to our earlier conversation about this being a battle between good and evil, a Tolkien-esque battle between good and evil. And it's hard to be more evil than trying to mislead humanity into making decisions that could result in the collapse of civilization itself. And so now, one thing I would mention, we do talk a lot about 1.5 Celsius, 3 Fahrenheit, as this level of warming where we start to see some of the worst consequences. But it isn't quite a tipping point. It's more like a, the way I look at it, it's we're going down this dangerous highway. And with each exit that we miss, there is greater and greater levels of danger. We've got to get off at the earliest exit. Now, there are some possible tipping points. You know, we warm the planet up to certain levels that can trigger some irreversible changes, like the collapse of ice sheets, like the, you know, the ocean circulation patterns can sort of fundamentally shift into a different mode. And so these are all possible tipping point elements. But overall, the planet continues to warm almost sort of linearly, as we say, steadily, as we continue to put carbon pollution into the atmosphere. It just gets steadily worse.
But the forces fighting against the facts of science are not just those on the right, evidently, because there are people on the left who see what you see and want to stop it, and yet they have put the brakes on things like nuclear power, and they don't want wind turbines off the coast because it spoils their view of the never-ending sea. It's like a perfect storm. You got people on both sides of the equation confounding your efforts. Talk about that.
Yeah, and some of it is, they sometimes call this a false flag, I guess. You know, some of that is inauthentic in the sense that there's been an effort on the right, and we see this from Fox News all the time. You know, Rupert Murdoch is apparently very concerned about birds because all he wants to talk about is how the birds are going to be hurt by wind turbines and how the whales are going to be hurt by wind turbines. We hear that all the time on Fox News. Are those environmentalists? Is Rupert Murdoch an environmentalist? No, this is an effort to actually take environmental progressives, those who would be most likely to demand action on climate, and convince them, hey, you better be careful there because like this clean energy could cause all of these other environmental problems. It's an effort to mislead, and a lot of good people get caught up in that effort. So now nuclear energy, there's a worthy debate to be had about the role of nuclear energy going forward. There are arguments that can be made in favor. There are a lot of arguments that can be made against it, not the least of which is expense. It's actually much more expensive than the clean energy alternatives. But some of that is not authentic. Some of that apparent opposition on the left is contrived, it's manufactured, and the intent is to divide. To divide and conquer, and it's one of the tactics that we've talked about.
The people in right-wing media who go on television or podcasts or radio or these blogs and write about the things that are in opposition to what you and your co-author know to be scientific fact are people that you call the pros and the propagandists, and they work hand in hand. These are people who are credentialed, in many cases, credentialed experts, often with university positions, who shill, and that is your word, for various industries. They write books, they do these op-eds, they appear on TV with mis- and disinformation. And if that is truly what they are, then I would imagine that their motivation is fame and money. Can you give us some examples of who these people are? Name names so that we can recognize them.
Well, we do. We do name names. On the climate and clean energy side of things, we talk about Bjorn Lomborg. He calls himself the skeptical environmentalist, but in fact, he's been supported by money that comes from the Koch brothers, fossil fuel interests, to promote these disingenuous talking points we've been talking about. Oh, yeah, climate change is real, but it's not going to be that bad. The solutions that, you know, climate advocates are proposing, like wind and solar, are actually going to be bad for them. So there are all of these misleading talking points, and the only thing they have in common is they constitute an argument for the status quo, for business as usual, for the fossil fuel industry. And Lomborg has actually gotten quite a bit of money from Bill Gates in recent years and is one of the primary advisors of Bill Gates. And so it isn't a coincidence that we see Bill Gates spouting these fossil fuel industry talking points because he's literally being handed them by his friend Bjorn Lomborg. Now, on the public health side, RFK Jr., obviously. And there, you know, it's not so much about money, I think, because he probably has as much money as he needs. It's about the fame. It's about the glory. And he has never been more prominent than he is now in the public discourse. So he has found a way to achieve Kennedy-like prominence, but it's sort of a deal with the devil that he's made.
And you single out a man named Steve Malloy, who is not a scientist, but it doesn't stop him, you say, from playing one on television. And he is described as, quote, as instrumental in spreading smears about climate scientists, among them you. And in fact, you say that he allegedly offered students at a seminar that you conducted money to... To ask you questions that would put you in a sticky position in terms of debunking the science that you promote.
Yeah, he was offering, I forget how much money, to anybody who would sort of attack me at a public lecture I was giving. I believe it was at UCLA some years ago. And yes, so he is literally, he takes money from the fossil fuel industry. He takes money from the tobacco industry. So years ago, he was out there saying, you know, tobacco is fine, there's no problem with tobacco products. He was on Fox News, you know, making that claim while he was taking money from the tobacco industry. In fact, it was so egregious that Fox News even apologized for it. But he then went ahead and saw where things were headed, that the real money is fossil fuels. And so he's become basically a paid advocate for the fossil fuel industry, attacking climate science, attacking climate scientists, attacking clean energy, and using the avenues he has available to him, in particular Fox News, to spread that misinformation.
So you have this pack of pros out there who are ubiquitous. They're all over television and radio and podcasts. You have these pack of propagandists, among them people like Joe Rogan, who has an enormous, enormous audience out there spreading their influence. What can you do to minimize that? They have the audience.
Yeah, well, you know, to another Tolkien quote here, you know, our list of allies grows thin. Which, you know, is sort of how it feels sometimes when you've got these plutocrats and petrostates like Russia and Saudi Arabia spreading misinformation and disinformation. What can we possibly do about this? Well, you know, we saw just the other day that we still have a voice and we still have a vote and we can change the direction of our politics when we turn out and vote. And we talk about this in the book. It was obviously written before this off-term election, but we talked about, as devastating as the what last election was when it comes to anti-science on climate, on COVID, because our government agencies are now staffed by climate deniers and anti-vaxxers, as bad as it is, we can still make a change if the people come out, speak truth to power, vote, and vote for politicians who are doing what's right for us rather than the bidding of these powerful interests.
It's also a perfect storm because you've always had these moneyed interests who have been trying to maintain the status quo because they have billions and billions of dollars at stake. But now we have this move in the United States, this push toward authoritarianism, and authoritarians always marginalize intellectuals and experts. They criticize and diminish institutions. So are these attacks on experts, on science, a part of a larger movement to weaken or end democracy in America? Is that yet another force working against you?
Well, it is, and we talk about that at some length in the book. Russia, again, is a petrostate. Its economy is largely driven by the extraction of the natural resources, in particular fossil fuels. And it has used all of the tools available to it to block global climate action. And one of the primary tools that they've used, tactics that they've used, is to literally try to destabilize Western democracies using, you know, social media and troll armies and bot armies to literally pollute our public discourse and lead voters astray. And to some extent, we've seen countries like the U.S. Succumb to that pressure. We've seen it in Europe. We've seen that in Australia as well. And so, yes, there is a larger agenda here. It's literally Western democracy itself, and it's under attack. And the anti-science attacks are part of that.
And it's not something that's coming. It is here. The Trump administration has shut down the apparatus that could protect us from future pandemics. Your co-author says the result is that today the United States has no pandemic preparedness. And they've also begun to reverse what little progress we've made toward putting a damper on the progress of climate change. Your book is one way to bring attention to this, but it's certainly not enough because there are hundreds of disinformation campaigns and campaigners. Are there other weapons in the arsenal besides this book and scientists going on TV and screaming from the rafters?
Yeah, I'd love to think that that's all that's necessary, but clearly, no, we need everybody to be involved here. And it gets back to this point I was making before. You know, there's urgency, but we have to remember that there's agency too. We have to believe that we can make a difference, because the other side, they want you to throw up your hands in defeat. They want you to feel so under assault. They want to instill so much fear and despair and disillusionment and doom, which leads to disengagement, to use alliteration again. They want you disengaged. And one of the ways to do that is to make it feel like just the weight of all this is too great to bear and there's nothing we can do. And that's why this last election was such an important and welcome reminder that we can make a change when we turn out and vote for it.
Bread and circuses come to mind. Take your mind off the reality so we can have our way with you. One thing you recommend is better communication by many more scientists, along with support and protection for those who speak out, like you and your co-author are doing. How would you recommend that these scientists get more access to our ears?
Yeah, thanks. It's important. And I want to be clear here. We're not saying that all scientists need to be out there speaking to the public. There are some scientists who's, probably best left alone in the laboratory doing what they do, doing the science that they do. But there's going to be some subset of young scientists who are scientists. They love talking about doing science. They love communicating it to the public and to others and to the policymakers. And we need to make sure that the resource is there, that there's the positive reinforcement. And too often there's been negative reinforcement to scientists who do that. They're dismissed as popularizers. Carl Sagan was blackballed from the National Academy of Sciences because they felt it was beneath a scientist to be involved in the public engagement that he was. And so we need to change that culture. There has been progress, but not enough.
And part of the reason we have people who are susceptible to mis- and disinformation is because of a lack of understanding of the scientific method and of science itself and what scientists do. And we did a show on this several years ago where people, when they think of scientists, they think of them as mad scientists, because the closest that they have ever come to a scientist is in a movie about a mad scientist. When you hear vaccine skeptics talk about why they're not getting vaccinated, not allowing their children to be vaccinated, they often mention, "I did my own research." Or they say to others, "Do your own research." Well, they're not scientists. Is that a fool's errand to do your own research? Where would you even begin? How would you know what to look at?
Yeah, and some of that is the result of an orchestrated effort, an inauthentic effort to question everything you read. Again, if you can bring into doubt scientific authorities. When it comes to climate, there's an obvious agenda there to cast doubt on the fact that there's a climate crisis and that we need to get away from fossil fuels. But there's similar forces in public health and in COVID-19 vaccines, similar stories there where, there is an effort to convince people that they shouldn't listen to the experts. RFK Jr. just the other day, maybe it was a week ago, said, "We have to stop listening to experts." He literally said that. So, stop going to your doctor, stop, everything that we do in modern life, we rely upon experts for our appliances to work, for our, just to get through the course of our lives, for put food on the table. Everything we do requires that we are making use of experts who know how to do things. And to say we should stop listening to them is a prescription for chaos. It plays to the bad actors. It's bad for us.
It is true that if you want to learn how to screw in a light bulb, there is a YouTube video that will show you how to do that. But that's the only thing you should rely on those YouTube videos to do, because they are not experts. They're you. And what do you know, right?
It take to screw in a light bulb, as they say, yes.
Dr. Michael Mann, along with Peter Hotez, have written Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World. They're not Chicken Little. The time is now, and the threat is serious. Thank you very much. I know you have to go teach class, so I'm going to let you go.
Thanks
you very
so much, Mike. Really
for the
enjoyed
hour.
It. Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.